Senate Interim Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness will come to order. Before we go to the vice chair, the Senate president is detained elsewhere and is on his way, and Senator Olson is temporarily excused. He is in an energy meeting elsewhere, and both of us will catch up a little bit later. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you know, we just celebrated Veterans Day, and I had the honor of speaking at the Heroes Memorial, which is in downtown Gresham. But some of the comments I made were actually taken from our esteemed Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs Director, Cameron Smith, who, as you all know, served three tours in Iraq as a U.S. Marine captain. But he talked about service members who have returned home and are using the leadership skills that they have, which they learned in the military, and they're contributing to our communities in a variety of different ways. And so I just wanted to list some of the people that he mentioned in that editorial. And we have to remember that one out of 12 Oregonians are veterans, and I have forgotten about that. And also we have to remember that many of our veterans have reintegrated into back to home face a lot of challenges, and they definitely need nothing but the best in care, resources, and support. But of course, I didn't know much about the National President of Gold Star Wives of America, and Judy Van Cleve, she's from Portland, and her late husband was a disabled Korean veteran, and she served for 20 years with the Gold Star Wives of America, who continue to honor our fallen and their families. You know, maybe we could have a little report on what the Gold Star Wives of America are like here in Oregon, because I hadn't heard about it. He mentioned Kim Duthit. She's a Coast Guard veteran, and she serves student veterans in her role as a veterans coordinator at Portland Community College, and she is a leader for both our fastest growing demographic, women veterans, and for all veterans across Oregon. And then Bill Griffith, he is a constituent of mine. He's a former Navy Corpsman who served in the Vietnam War, and he was given the Governor's Volunteer Award for being a long-term care ombudsman. And what he does is he lives in Gresham, but he travels to the Dalles to the Oregon Veterans Home and meets with the veterans there. And to me, that's service at your best. And then, of course, there's Chris Mintz. He was the an Army veteran who chose to run into that chaos at Umpqua Community College campus to help protect fellow students. And he was shot multiple times, and he continues to recover, and it sure would be nice to know how he's doing and if a note or something could be sent to him, if that's possible. Again, hopefully the department has some information on how to let him know that he's in our thoughts and prayers. And of course, the renowned Alex Scarlatos, he captured headlines when he thwarted that terrorist attack while traveling in France. And I know this is very because of the tragedy of the terrorist killings in France. I watched Dancing with the Stars, and he is now in the finals. Alex Scarlatos is. Can you believe a young veteran being as talented as that? He's good. Anyway, he was in the Oregon Army National Guard, And so those were just some of the volunteers that I, or veterans that I wanted to remember today in my comments. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. For members of the public and those of the audience, we're actually going to go right down the informational meeting schedule. Senator Knope's going to join us here in about 2 minutes to talk about veterans employment and bridge programs. The first topic that's on there actually is emergency fuel, which is just an update. If you'll remember, colleagues and those who are following this, there's been a fuel work group for catastrophic response working for quite some time on this. At the bottom of the program, at the Ready, Set, Go wildfire stuff, we'll come back and talk briefly about that. However, we do anticipate in discussions with leadership to have a small bill relating to catastrophic fuel access during the next session. That's kind of under draft, under work with LC and staff, and I'll come around and meet the various members with that. With that, we'll move on to the second topic, which is the Veterans Employment Bridge Program. If Senator Knope will join us, Council, you want to tee anything up here? Or let him run solo?
Mr. Chair, I'm available as
you're solo. And you see the esteemed member of our committee, Senator Courtney, has joined us.
It looks like Senator Olson, according to the name badge, but we'll have to swap those.
He might be having one of those days. He might want to be Senator Olson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, State Senator Tim Knope, Senate District 27, which includes Ben Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. And, of course, we need to congratulate the good senator for the new grandchild and his family. I think that's awesome. I'm here today, though, to talk about veterans bridge programs, and I received an email from a veteran in my district who works for the local hospital, and he's very concerned about veterans who are coming back and are needing employment and wants to make that as seamless and easy as possible. And so he suggested that we look at some veteran employment bridge programs, and I started in investigating this and researching this, and there are all kinds of programs from federal, state, and I've talked with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and so I think there is a lot of work to be done to try to figure out what we can do to be helpful and to not duplicate what is currently going on, but I think there's definitely a need that's there. And I put this email out to some of the committee members, and Chair Mona Sanderson of the Healthcare Committee indicated some interest, as did others, in looking at this issue. And so whatever we can do to help veterans regain employment and assimilate back into society, I think we should do, because we need to honor their service and sacrifice for what they've done. And so I'm going to continue to work on this. I just wanted to flag the committee that I don't know where this is going to end up. I don't know if it's in education or healthcare or veterans or where it ends up and if it's 2016 or 2017, but I wanted to make sure that you guys were aware of this, because it certainly has a primary veteran element to it. So I thank you for the opportunity to just bring it forward with you today.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair.
And thank you, Senator Knope. I was really intrigued by it, and I think it's an excellent idea. Just to make clarify, veterans who have had training, say in medical care or, let's just choose medical care, then when they come back to Oregon, if somehow we could have a system where they could fast track into either an EMT program or a nursing program or something like that. Isn't that the idea?
Yeah, that's certainly an element of the idea. And as you all know, we are lacking in healthcare workers, and we have veterans who are coming back who have probably more experience in trauma and in serving in that field. And the quicker that we can get them into our nursing programs and PA programs and get them through the process, I think the better off the public's going to be, and certainly they'll be in terms of employment. So that's definitely a significant element to this.
Thank you.
It's interesting, because yesterday during the Rules Committee, one of the board appointees was a retiree, second-term retiree, veteran, Air Force veteran, dental field. He'd come out of the Air Force and then become into the dental field, and now he's retired from the dental field and practice down in Newport. But what was intriguing to me is in 1961, when he came out of the military, he went immediately into his field that he was trained in the military and started in the private sector in that field in 1961. And as he pointed out, now, with the same level of training, he couldn't do that. He would have to go through all this other stuff, so on and so forth like that. So even though we've made a lot of progress, there's still a lot of holes in the system that's there. I'm just curious, because most of us on this committee sometimes are too close to the fire, because you know we're working on it, and the committee has been doing this for a long time. When you went to CERT research, because you said, you know, what programs are out there, and you said you were surprised to find so many programs, was there a single location that you went to that was integrated, consolidated, in which, you know, I'm a veteran, I need a job, I can go to this, and this is the way to do it? Or did you have to hunt and peck?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that is part of the problem. I mean, certainly the Department of Veterans Affairs, I mean, they have the programs, but then there's federal programs, and there's layers, and there's programs for disabled veterans for employment, and then there's, a normally discharged veteran and programs for them, and there's state programs, and, you know, and there are multiple different departments, and so what you have is, you know, layers of government who may or may not be working together. And so I think those are things we need to sift through and figure out how we can make this as easy as possible for a veteran to figure out what their options are. And I know the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs is very interested, has programs, is, you know, wanted to work with us. And I know the HAC, they offer certain credits and things like that. So we just need to figure out what's out there today and what we can do and get as close to 1961 as possible.
You're right.
Good years, by the way.
Any questions? We appreciate you bringing it to attention. We look forward to working with you and seeing if we can consolidate this. And I think everybody on the Veterans Committee is, you know, this is pretty much has been a nonpartisan committee all the way through since its creation, and so everybody's trying to figure out how to do the best thing. And the key thing now is that as the federal government unfortunately cuts its programs related to veterans, it's up to the state to continue to keep the limelight on this and to try and help our own people reintegrate, get jobs, and stay in the system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have always appreciated the bipartisan, bicameral nature of our effort for veterans and the support that they get in Oregon. And I know we all want to do more, and maybe through this effort we can do more.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to move on to legislative emergency planning. If Mr. Hayden will go ahead and come forward so that he can, you know, walk through our minefield here. Colleagues, if you recall, Senator or Representative Lively and I have been working on updating our business continuity plan. There's a whole facet of other little of plans and things that kind of have to be incorporated. That our good legislative administration has been kind of taking the lead in the effort on that, and so they're going to kind of give us an update, tell us a little of the octopus lines that go out in different directions, and then we'll go forward from there. You're on.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Kevin Hayden. I'm the legislative administrator. Thank you for the opportunity to talk this morning about what we've been doing for the last 6 months or so. It was time first to starting to look at emergency planning, to basically look at what we have and start revising and work from the ground up. So what we started with first was our emergency action plan, which is really the first 15 minutes after an emergency occurs. How do we really make sure that people in the building stay safe, that they can evacuate, or that they have the right information to be safe as any emergency develops? Nick Herrera in my office has done a lot of research. He started looking at our plan and modeled it after some FEMA best practices. And then after he took a first swag at writing up a new or revised plan, we have been shopping it around, talking with the Office of Emergency Management, State Police, the Salem Fire Department, Salem Emergency Management, Marion County. He's been working with the desks, the legislative service agencies, and we have been walking around and talking with each of the primary partners in the building from the governor's office, the secretary of state, and the treasurer's office to make sure that our plan not only worked for the legislature, but for everybody who is in the building at any given time. We looked first at the risks, made sure that we had a fairly decent risk analysis, and then started looking at each of the incident action plans for the different kinds of emergencies, whether that's fire, flooding, suspicious packages, bomb threats, medical emergencies, power failures, pretty much the gamut of things that might go wrong at any building everywhere, and then starting to apply the unique nature of this building to how we can work through those. We have the plan in pretty much a final draft form. We just have a few more people to walk it through and talk it over with, and then we will publish it and start working on training. So training both our Blue Vest monitors here in the building, who are our eyes and ears out on the floors. They are people who work in every office and with staff all over the building to help you in an emergency, to make sure that you're evacuating and that you have the information. We'll also be starting a series of both individualized training, so small group trainings, large building-wide trainings, just so that people really begin to understand kind of what the expectation is, what the fire department's going to be looking for if it's a fire, what the police department's going to be looking for, you know, what the first responders in any case are going to be doing so that they know how to best keep themselves safe as they move forward. It assigns responsibilities within the plan with a term of succession, so that if the primary responsibility for coordinating efforts goes to me, if I'm not available, there will be people in place and trained up each level down the line to ensure that no one person is the failure point and that we can keep everybody safe. Of course, that's really the easy part of the emergency planning, because there's a lot of information out there about how to work on those kinds of emergencies and threats. The next big step is the whether you call it business continuity planning or continuity of operations planning. That's where we are moving to next. We do have a business continuity of plan. It's dated, so it needs updated as well. And it's really siloed to just us. As part of this, as we're moving forward, there's kind of the larger continuity of governance that I know this committee and others have been working on, as far as how is the state going to operate in the big picture arena, and how we operate to provide the tools to the legislature so that you can do your job in an emergency, is the part that we are starting to work on. So that's the simplest part of that, is we'll be working with each agency, talking about what their needs are, from everything as short as we don't have access to the building for a short period of time, to the big catastrophic event that takes us out of the building for a long period of time and does damage statewide. So we'll be working on a scalable plan that addresses all of that. As part of that, there is a fledgling business continuity plan community of practice that's under the beginning leadership of Mike Matthews at DHS and Eric Rao at OEM. We have joined with them so that our business continuity of plan does work together with what the rest of the state is doing, and that we can hopefully create a generalized, similar look and feel to how the plans work, so that we're all talking the same language and working the same way, which in any kind of a conflict or an emergency is a huge part of the internal threat, to make sure that we're working together. At the last meeting, which was just last week, the attendees had a lot of the same concerns that we did about exactly how we work together and what those seams are. So we've got the we've got a start, and we're really at the beginning phase. some of the first things that we really have to work out is that continuity of governance, because I can make a really great plan as to how the legislature is going to work, but if it doesn't feed into how the bigger picture works, doesn't do anybody any good. So that's really our two-pronged next step is, one, working with the service agencies to start working on what do they need in order to do their job in a business continuity scenario, but also to start to focus with a lot of those same people, whether it's from the governor's office, from OEM, DAS, the treasurer's office, secretary of state, and the judicial branch, as to how exactly we're going to operate, where we're going to operate in different threat scenarios, so we can look at what we need to do and be ready to accomplish. So it will be an interesting road ahead of us. I'm sure that there will be lots of challenges, and we will work with our partners to get through it, and then we'll hopefully have a much better plan as time goes by.
Okay. Questions, comments? Easy day. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're now going to move into to fire and lessons learned for the most part. First one up is aviation fuel shortfalls during the 2015 fire season. Mr. Decker and Mr. Graff are here, are going to come up. This is really a lesson learned. This is one of those, they're going to kind of outline the story so that we're familiar with it. If you remember at the top, we talked about the choke point for a catastrophic event is fuel. And during the fires, there were a couple of things that came up. And so there are a few lessons learned of the stories in regards to aviation fuel that, you know, we just need to take note of for future planning. Again, it was resolved. It turned out not to be a showstopper, but it turned out for something to us to pay attention to in future planning. So, Doug, if you would.
Very good. Thank you. Good morning, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Decker. I'm Oregon State Forester, Director of the Oregon Department of Forestry. I'm joined this morning by Doug Graff. Doug is the Chief of Fire Protection for ODF. Appreciate your comment about continuous improvement. That's an important aspect of our organization, continuing to learn those lessons. We're here to follow up with you this morning on those two topics related to wildland firefighting. First is maintaining access to fuel, which is very important to us, aviation fuel, particularly in remote locations, and then secondly on mobilization of the and training of the Oregon National Guard to assist us with wildland firefighting. And I know that when we get to that spot, Doug will walk us through that, and Dave Stuckey will join us at the table as well. So I guess I'd open with a brief summary of the aviation fuel shortage issue, just by noting that at this particular point in time, ODF protection, we protect about 16 million acres of forest land, has not been impacted by the shortages of aviation fuel, but the two of our key partners were impacted, both the Bureau of Land Management as well as the Rangeland Fire Protection Community, particularly working out of the Burns Airport. They were impacted in 2014 multiple times, nine times, by not having enough aviation fuel when the airport ran out. And so the airport manager in Burns, being a resourceful person, wanted to get ahead of the problem for 2015, was able to acquire a 6,000-gallon fuel tanker through the Federal Excess Property Program that was essentially a rolling reservoir. And that helped, but was still not the answer during a particularly busy time of air operations with single-engine air tankers and with helicopters. And the limiting factor there appeared to be a set of motor carrier administrative rules called the hours of service rules that restrict the number of hours in consecutive service that a driver can operate a fuel truck. And the principle, I think, is sound. It's based on safety. Unfortunately, in Oregon's most remote locations, particularly during challenging fire periods, having access to aviation fuel is also a safety issue and a critical operational issue for us. So what I think was happening was the fire operations were using fuel faster than they could supply it and still comply with the rule. So on August 17th, the governor issued an executive order that suspended the hours of service rules for 10 days, specifically for trucks hauling aviation fuel to airports that were supporting the wildland firefighting effort, and that allowed for a timely resupply. I think the lesson learned on that particular one was that the hours of service rules need to be flexible during an emergency, and particularly in rural Oregon, where it takes a while to get there with supplies, that would allow us in a way to continue our air operations during during a catastrophic situation. So I think that's the essence of that particular lesson learned and topic. Be glad to take any comments or questions, and then we'll move into the National Guard mobilization piece.
The only comment, I mean, if you look, what we're saying here is if you, in our planning and what we deal, because we really don't deal with the 9/11 response calls for the most part at this committee, but more of the catastrophic and emergency planning, comes down to the issue of if you have a catastrophic 9/0 earthquake, we're going to be operating out of rural Oregon with both aviation and motor fuels. And this is the sort of reason this committee passed previously legislation giving the governor authority in catastrophic events to be able to waive some of these rules and regulations for emergency response. And it's one of those planning factors that, okay, when it does happen, there are these things we're going to have to do at the state level quickly, because at the implementation level, you would be surprised. The Senate president was just reminding me here in the committee about, you know, kind of how you train is how you fight. There are a series of things that you're supposed to do. And if the average person, even in an emergency, goes down their checklist of, you know, hours, so on and so forth, they will default to what they know, which is mean, oh, you can only drive 8 hours. Doesn't matter that Western Oregon has sunk into the ocean. You can still only drive 8 hours until we get this block checked. And that is the key lesson learned here. And I was not aware that, you know, somebody with a little, you know, independent ingenuity over at the Burns Airport started the whole ball rolling towards the state and said, hey, Salem, we have a problem. Let's look at solutions for this. Here are options to fix that. I did have the state forester in my office, you know, to remind them that there is the normal planning, and they are good at fire response. They're good at those sorts of things. But to ensure that they stay involved with what Mr. Hayden said is that when the big one happens, there's another whole mindset of thinking outside of the box that has to transpire. Mm-hmm. And this committee hasn't addressed it too much, but one of the options that we discussed, and I would like you to touch briefly on, are two things that are out there. Is in the next topic we're going to come to, and it is the mobilization and training during fire season of the National Guard, is during a catastrophic emergency that this committee types deal with, the Guard's going to be preoccupied with doing other things. And so they're not going to be available. But it suddenly dawned on the meeting with Doug and his people that they have another asset that during portions of the year are the fire crews, contract fire crews, DOC fire crews, and so on and so forth, which are an asset sitting out there that most people have not thought in the equation of an emergency response during a catastrophic event. So if you could just talk briefly in regards to crewing and structure, because what we're going to go into is mobilization and training on the Guard side, but the question is those other pieces, the DOC, the private crews, those assets that may or may not be available.
Right. Very good. So we participate in a regional, national, and international system of being able to move firefighting resources around very, very rapidly. Maybe not as rapidly sometimes as we would like, but we have access to a wide array of people and equipment, and we participate in that during when we're not in a serious time of need here. We've actually sent our folks out of state to help fight fire and manage emergencies in other western states and other east coast states. Last year we were the beneficiary of about 35 states sent equipment, people, aircraft to Oregon to help us fight fire here. And so and from time to time we are asked, we have shower units and tool caches and a variety of equipment in different parts of the state. And it's actually happened in recent weeks when other agencies have reached out to us to help them, and we do that and gladly participate in that. So I think the all-risk nature of the wildland fire response and our access to assets throughout the West and Canada and even overseas can be an asset. And we would certainly be, we would be drawing on that in the midst of multiple fire catastrophes. We've also actually begun a conversation at the request of the Department of Administrative Services with the Enterprise Leadership Team about the role about ICS. And, you know, we have three incident management teams that are Type 1 national teams here in Oregon that are part of ODF. And trying to get everyone across the enterprise thinking about ICS and emergency management. You know, we've offered up a couple of case studies of how incident management teams can be used to do a lot of different to help manage a lot of different type of events and situations. And so we're helping to spread that across the state enterprise. So hopefully that addresses your comment. I think there is a ready resource here.
Can you throw some numbers out there, or your colleague there, in terms of the number of Department of Corrections crews that are out there, roughly the number of commercial crews that are available in the state?
Right.
And then I think the key point you're talking about is, unfortunately, many of us who deal with the federal government, you know, they come in and check into the local hotel and start setting up. And as we know, there won't be a lot of local hotels in some cases in a catastrophic event. But your structure and it is considerably different. Even without a National Guard component, you go out, set up a camp, self-sustaining, that sort of thing. Can you?
Indeed. Yeah. Good morning, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Doug Graff. I serve as the Chief of Fire Protection for Oregon Department of Forestry. To the question of the crew availability for all emergency, the Department of Corrections crew staffs about 30 fire crews, 10-person crews that are readily available to us during fire season. We have mobilized the DOC crews, the fire crews, and the kitchen and camp support crews that support our kitchens to all risk hazard deployments within the state of Oregon. To my knowledge, what we have not done is exercise the contract crew world in this arena. We have 190 contract crews. These are 20-person contract crews that are trained in professional firefighters, and they operate on the fire front throughout the year, every year, and this is from the private sector. So their focus and training is in wildland fire. So this is one concept to explore in the all risk. But currently, in the current framework, ODF employees, our infrastructure, part of the emergency operation centers for the state when that's initiated, and the Department of Correction crews are made available for all risk.
Just a follow-up question, and then turn over to the committee members. Can you give just a characterization of the size? This year and last year were rather unusual fire seasons. But having said that, you would have, because as you pointed out, you're responsible, or your colleagues in the other agencies are responsible for running these camps. So if you have these fire crews and everybody, I mean, how many fire camps, let me talk firefighting, how many camps, size and population did the agency support? And I think if you see where I'm going, mm-hmm. I'm going to refugee camps, okay? That's the direction I'm going here, right?
Chair Boquist, in regards to what the department can provide in terms of logistics support for fire camps and all risk camps, we staff three support systems for incident management teams, and we staff three incident management teams. These are 30-person teams with an incident commander, logistics section chiefs, finance section chief, operations, and so on. Very organized in the military framework for fighting fire. So we, at any given time, we can staff three systems. Each camp is designed to organize approximately up to 2,000 firefighters on a day. That's three meals a day, breakfast, lunch from the Department of Correction crew, SAC lunch program, and hot meals for breakfast and dinner. That's essentially what we manage and organize towards. In terms of what Oregon hosted throughout the season, that's much greater. Mm-hmm. These teams were deployed several times throughout the fire season, and certainly in the last several fire seasons. These teams and these systems have been very active. Across the state of Oregon, we hosted 41 teams this last year, fire season, which is significant for Oregon. Large fires across the state. So we rely on the national system to support all those other fires across the state. It's not a condition within the department that we can handle on our own.
So, when you say 41 systems, because your in organic capacity is roughly three camps of 2,000, and then you've had up to 41 different, not simultaneously, but 41 different locations.
Correct.
And because, I mean, since you've not been involved in the modeling, and I think I mentioned this yesterday, we don't think Washington will exist as far as we're concerned in terms of immediate response in a catastrophic event. How many, what percentage of those assets getting to 41 are outside of the state of Washington?
Chair Boquist, yeah, absolutely. So
if Washington is helping itself.
Specifically,
what's left?
For the department, we deployed eight times this year and supported those eight deployments with our cash systems. Mm-hmm. So that gives you a perspective what percentage that ODF supported. Mm-hmm. And recognize also that these incident management teams and the support systems that roll come from a variety of places across the state. So if there is a natural disaster in one area of the state, you know, can we count on the full system, the full suite of people? That would be a challenge, depending on what the route access is and the connection.
Do you have a last question? Just by the way, I know you don't have his fingertips, but maybe a guesstimation or rough order of magnitude of the fire crews and the assets that are there, how many of them are outside of the Willamette Valley or the coast region? What percentage of your crews and assets do you think?
This would be a really rough estimate.
And you know why I'm asking the question, right?
I would consider probably a third, a third, a third. A third in eastern Oregon, a third through the center of the state, Central Valley, a third on the coast. That's a very rough estimate of the personnel. Much of the infrastructure would be in Salem. We do pre-position our communication units and our fire cache systems in eastern Oregon or in southern Oregon to help facilitate deployment. Okay.
Questions? Senator Olson, please.
Mr. Decker, you have an open-ended contract with Heavy Lift Helicopters, correct?
Chair Boca, Senator Olson, when you say an open-ended contract.
By that, I mean you can call them up and say, I need you to help come fight a fire.
We negotiate those before season, right?
Right. And I know that emergency management doesn't have that same ability. So if there was a catastrophic event, could we rely on you to use your contracts to support the heavy lift helicopter situation?
If I could, Senator Olson, we did work in coordination with the heavy lift contractors a couple years ago through Oregon Emergency Management. To coordinate with the current what we call when needed resources and contracts with those resources. So they're not procured and secured on a daily availability,
right,
but we know the rates and understand how to procure them at a time of need. So call when needed resources. There was conversation through OEM around and through the consortium of heavy lift contractors say, we want to be available for all risk. How do we make that happen? So we coordinated with the Office of Emergency Management and matched those call when needed resources. They realigned the details in terms of what mission capacities they would have for all risk. And those details was the work of the consortium with partner with ODF and OEM. I think we closed out that effort maybe perhaps a couple years ago. And I know we did have that conversation a couple years. We had several meetings with that consortium and OEM. So my understanding at this point is we do have that capability to procure those resources in a timely fashion if needed for all risk.
Mr. Chair, the reason I ask that is in Senate Bill 94 last session, there was a section in there that allowed OEM to coordinate with heavy lift helicopters. And since the bill didn't move forward, I thought perhaps we could take a look at that again so that we could have, you know, a direct connection. Would that be right, Mr. Stuckey? Or?
Well, Mr. Stuckey, come on up. We're moving to the next topic. So you can give your 25 cents on
94.
The answer to this question, and then we'll move on to the next one.
Well, good morning, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. I'm Dave Stuckey, Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department. To answer your question, Senator Olson, what we did to continue on with what Mr. Graff just got done briefing, what the Office of Emergency Management did is we created an RFP or a contract to tap into that heavy lift consortium and those helicopter companies. So by the end of this month, we will have an RFP on the street. DAS is managing this process. not confident that legislation is necessarily needed. We're really modeling a lot of this after what our statutes allow in 401 on the emergency management side, and then we're taking all the best practices and lessons learned from ODF. And their call when needed lists and their capability and how they manage those assets during upcoming fire season is spectacular. And quite frankly, we just stole it all and called it our own.
Well, Mr. Chair, this was a concern I had. What was it, 2 years ago, we talked over at helicopter transport, and we tried to get that into the resilience bill, but it didn't happen. But as long as it got it taken care of, I guess we don't have to worry about it.
Senator Olson, I'd be happy to brief you and bring in our Director of Office Emergency Manager, Andrew Phelps, and talk to you about that in person.
That's fine. I just was concerned because the bill didn't pass, and that particular piece was in there to give you the opportunity to have the same functionality that the Forest Service did. But so if it's covered, then we're taken care of. I won't need to do anything. Thank you.
Okay, next topic. So we'll move on here. So we left off the governor's executive order middle of August relative to suspending the rules of service on the hours of service rules. By the middle of August of this year, Oregon had experienced significant fire activity. We'd had the Caney Creek fire in John Day, but we still had, this is the middle of August, we still had about 80 20-person contract crews at our disposal. So we had a good chunk of the contractors that were still in the availability mode. We had not yet experienced the multiple wind-driven range and timber fires that we had in Wallowa, Baker, Union, and Umatilla counties. In a period of a few short days there, as we moved through middle August, we did have major wind-driven firestorms across northeast Oregon, significant fire growth, 30, 40,000 acre fires in one burning period in one day. And that was coupled by a significant drawdown of firefighting resources both here in Oregon as well as in Washington. Washington actually had more significant fire activity than we did. And so at our request, the governor mobilized the National Guard on August 19th to be ready for a significant containment and control workload that would be suitable for Guard mobilization, really the kind of those large wind-driven fires on the east side. I think Doug is going to kind of walk us through the timing, the considerations, the ways in which we work with the National Guard, as well as a little bit of history about how we've worked together. And I think Dave will also be able to talk about the training regime there as well.
So. Excellent. Thank you, Doug. Again, my focus will be to recap the deployment of the National Guard fire crews through Ops Plan Smokey with a focus on lessons learned. Every spring, we work with the military department to coordinate on the Ops Plan Smokey, which is the vehicle in which we can initiate the National Guard once we have a state declaration of emergency. That was completed in the spring. In July, initiated fire activity, as Doug expressed, and specifically the Stouts Creek fire, you may recall, in southwest Oregon, really initiated for us a state of emergency where we had a necessary need for additional aviation aircraft. Then we coordinated with the military department to deploy aviation aircraft. These are heavy helicopters once the contract ships have been all deployed. We have built a very strong relationship over the past several years and decades prior to that, but in terms of exercising the past several years, I would call the aviation component here very seamless. It's a phone call away, very efficient, trained together, coordinate. These folks know how to fight fire, and I will recall just a moment in time three, 4 years ago training with the National Guard, and it was difficult to make them to hover over the fire and drop the bucket because they want to come in hot and heavy, and it was very interesting watching this dynamic and evolution of change. Today, I would say fantastic. They know the mission, and they slow the pace down to hover over those fires and put the water where we need them. Continuing through the fire season, we saw additional deployments on the aviation assets to Grizzly Bear Complex and the Cornet Windy Complex in Canyon Creek, and they serviced several different fires from that site in eastern Oregon. August marked the first time since 2002 that we trained and deployed National Guard boots on the ground, what we call them firefighters. We trained them and deployed 375 National Guard members That's three battalions, organized them into 16 20-person crews, trained them as entry-level firefighters, so they're available to the state on all lands, private, federal, state lands, to fight fire for that qualification. And we deployed them ultimately to the Canyon Creek fires and the Grizzly Bear Complex. The mission of the National Guard crews is a critical mission. It's not the glorious mission right up against the fire front at the initial attack. Really where the National Guard troops come in as entry-level firefighters is to hold the lines, is to protect the investment that we've created by the professional crews that do this on a daily basis. And it's a critical mission for us. It's taking the fire to the finish line and protecting that investment. So we often have the privilege and opportunity to prepare for that need and know when that need is coming in advance of the need. And those specific fires on the landscape dictated the call through the governor's office to initiate the National Guard training and deployment for boots on the ground. I'll highlight the professional crews. Again, I mentioned we have the 190 contract crews, highly effective, highly trained. And then you may know the Type 1 crews, or better known as the hotshot crews. These are the interagency crews nationally. These folks would have the highest qualifications. So in the framework of available crews, the National Guard crews are entry level, play a critical role containment. The Type 2 contract crews are professionals, and we'll put them anywhere on the line. But when we have the real tough ground and complex incidents, that's where we use the hotshot crews. So there's distinctions between those crews and what those mission capabilities are. Lessons learned this year from deployments. I'd highlight that Department of Public Safety and Standards training really did a fantastic job on the training. In 2013 and 2014, we both looked at the threshold and considered the need for those training of the National Guard troops on the ground. We ultimately did not need that. We did not have the mission for the training and deployment of those crews. But along the way, we worked closely with DPSST and the Ori Military Department around how do we gain efficiencies when the call does come. We have the training facilities. And to my understanding, this was the first time that we used the DPSST facility, and it was very effective. And we moved three battalions through that system. So lessons learned from us is we've talked about this for several years, given the intensity of the last fire season. And that system worked very well. Also new to the discussion is financing the training of the National Guard. As the BLM supported the financials to $250,000 in support through the BLM contract that we have. So we have not exercised the contract in that way. So that was favorable to support the total cost of the training, which was $750,000 to train the 375 Guardsmen. I'd also highlight that we know the bottleneck here, which is the crew leadership. And this proved to be challenging. Given that these are civilian crews, we're taking them from their day job and training them as firefighters and putting them on the fire line. We do not have crew bosses with those crews. We need to procure those through the ranks of ODF. That's difficult to do because when our greatest time of need, we don't have the capacity. And as Doug mentioned, this is where we relied on other states. So during the time of training, we were able to bring in single resource bosses, which is the crew boss. These are high-level training, mid-level management within the fire organization that they can lead and support the crew on the management side of the business, and those are crew bosses. But definitely a bottleneck. We want to think about how we can expand the capacity of that resource to be more effective. We have a couple opportunities based on this experience. We've trained the Guard as entry-level firefighters. Now they're available to us for the next 5 years in that capacity. What we need to do is provide them a refresher, which is a one-day training to ensure if we have the call for them to deploy within the next 5 years, they have the basic firefighter training. We can provide them a one-day training and put them on the line. So we have some efficiencies that were gained. We recognize that there is some attrition in terms of the returning availability of those individuals over time. With that, I'll turn it over to Military Department.
Well, good morning again. Just a high level, couple of points I'd like to reinforce that Mr. Graff mentioned. Op Plan Smokey is an annual agreement that we have between our two agencies, and we take a lot of lessons learned from that. The basic premise of that is that the two of us can, as agencies, can understand the costs and the requirements that exist in order to activate the National Guard. One of the main components, at least on our side, is the fact that the pay status and the type of status that a guardsman in is. Some of you may be familiar with the fact that we have three basic tenets. We have a Title 10 status if you're off overseas fighting war. You have a Title 32 for a guardsman that is, and it's a U.S. code, that is in a drill weekend status or AT, and then we're on state active duty if we're fighting inside the state of Oregon for fires or doing floods. And so it's that state active duty component that's really important to us. The Op Plan Smokey helps use that leverage both internally, or externally between us and ODF, but also internally in order to be able to reinforce and support USPFO and pay back the federal government some of the use of the equipment that we're using on the state active duty time frame. And so we get it's quite a science behind it. It's we usually have a fine-tuned art on it, particularly as it applies to ODF and how they reimburse us and be able to get it to military department. Some of the money that goes into the firefighters or the soldiers, that just goes into their pocket, but some of the aviation costs, those go right back to USPFO and the federal government, and the military department's just kind of a pass-through for some of that cash. I would like to remind you that this mission is it was all volunteer force this past summer. We had three crews of 125, as Mr. Graff mentioned. We want to keep it in the volunteerism. That's one of our lessons learned. We certainly have the authority to, the Adjutant General does, to order soldiers and airmen to state active duty, but quite frankly, we want the people that want to be out there. And of the 375 ground crews that we had out there, they all wanted it. I had an opportunity to visit them with the Adjutant General on a couple of occasions. Quite frankly, they enjoyed it. They love that mission of supporting the state of Oregon and supporting the citizens of our state. It's a very, very easy sell, and it's something that they're capable of doing. They are not hotshot crews. They're citizen soldiers. They're soldiers that are really good in their civilian life as well as on the National Guard side. They're mechanics, they're truck drivers, they're infantrymen, they're tank drivers, they're F-15 mechanics. They're not wildland firefighters. And so as such, it takes a little bit in order to make certain that these soldiers, these citizen soldiers and airmen, are transitioned successfully. A couple of things is the 5 days of training that it takes to get them that certification process. We appreciate that Oregon Department of Forestry and the incident command teams that they put out in the field, as well as the federals, they don't put them on the tip of the spear. These citizen soldiers are the tip of the spear overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan for the last 10 years. Over here, we'd like to keep them down just a little bit lower, closer to the shaft, in order to make certain that they can do their job, support the state, but also make certain that they're doing it within their mission parameters. And so with that, there's a couple of things that we got out of this. We're tied at the hip when we move into a fire season with ODF. Our Joint Operations Center at the ARC, as well as half a mile away, is the AOC for ODF. Constant conversations, coordination calls, standard rhythm meetings. The same time at the level, senior level, we have managers constantly talking. Can't tell you how many times that Andrew Phelps in emergency management, myself, others, were talking to Mr. Deckard's senior management to make certain that we're straight on what their expectations are of us. So when they call us, we're come running. Consistently, they always ask for the aviation components first. Those soldiers, those helicopter pilots, those guys can and do an excellent job out there with the other Type 1 aircraft. Yes, a couple of years ago, we're going in hot. It's still hot. It's a very dangerous situation out there. Firefighting with helicopters is not easy, and some of our combat veterans are out there saying this is not something that you take lightly. You got to be out there. You got to make certain that you are absolutely 100% on your game. In fact, some of them even challenged this and said, you know, some of the conditions, perfect setting. We got to make certain that everything is done, communications, command, control, control graphics, et cetera, but it's still at the same time, it's as dangerous as combat flying missions that they've seen overseas in Afghanistan. So I'd like to say inherently, this is a very, very risky operation, and I think ODF does a fantastic job in their incident management teams in mitigating some of that risk so we can be out there and help support. In regards to the crews themselves, as Mr. Graf said, 2002 is the last time we deployed firefighters. We did it a couple of times with ground troops. The National Guard can do traffic control points real easy. In 2013, in the Biscuit fires and everything, the big fire season we had down in Southern Oregon, we sent a significant number of people that were just helping blanket all those roads and road closures, et cetera, to make certain that people weren't endangered when and not driving into a hazardous fire condition. This year, 375 soldiers and airmen were trained. Two Army crews, one air crew. We're two-thirds Army, we're one-third air. And so those crews will be ready again next year. We'll need to do that four-hour, that one-day training event. We're in discussions with ODF and as well as internally to figure out the best way to do that. But from our standpoint, we're absolutely looking forward to it, and we believe that it's our responsibility. From a timing standpoint, members of the committee, it was no surprise by the time the resource request came. Many of you are familiar with the Oregon Emergency Response System, or OERS. Well, ODF uses OERS just like everyone else does. They call in the OERS number to OEM. OEM says, okay, let's task this to so-and-so. And in reality, that's exactly what happens with the National Guard troops. So on the 19th of August, ODF submitted a request for OERS for the first fire team of 125. On the 21st, a couple of days later, we were at DPSST training. And so, quite frankly, a couple of day lag with citizen soldiers that had to get off their jobs and get into uniform, we thought that was pretty good. Quite frankly, we typically tell ODF it takes give us about a week to try and transition our citizen soldiers and airmen out of civilian life and into the military or wildland firefighting standpoint. Teams 2 and 3, a little bit shorter. We got the resource request on the 24th, and then we were at DPSST on the 25th. Kind of close this with there's a couple of lessons learned that we got out of them. One of them is clearly DPSST. Director Gablitz is not in the room today, but he did an absolutely fantastic job. General Stencil was out there following the fire season and coined his entire crew. He had multiple hours beyond the regular duty hours. In fact, we even have pictures of Director Gablitz handing out shirts to our guys at 10 o'clock at 2200 at night to make certain that they have the firefighting PPE out there. And so we very much appreciate the effort that he did, not only in the way he trained our soldiers, but the support that he gave them when they were out at DPSST. And so that's one lesson. And then the crew boss, Mr. Graf mentioned, is very, very challenging. How we manage that is going to be difficult. This is a National Guard, Western States, Oregon Department of Forestry, Natural Resource issue. We're a part of multiple phone conversations at the National Guard Bureau level with all the adjutant generals of the Western States. They're all facing this crew boss shortfall. They had the soldiers, they had the airmen to get out there and help fight the fire and support their states. They just didn't have that smart crew boss, that trained crew boss, to help manage that one crew of 20. And so that's going to be an ongoing discussion and how we kind of work through that process. And so with that, I would be happy to answer any questions.
I want to go back to Department of Forestry. Can you just outline, first off, to clarify for the record, which you have to fail to realize is, you know, you're on videotape here, so everybody's watching this, okay? So just keep that in mind. Is that what you had an expanded conversation, and we agreed in my office that I would ask you questions to, you know, lead you on to this, you know, to make sure the whole story got out. Back to the first portion, before we get to the mobilization, in blunt terms, welcome to the committee of death and doom here, okay? So, in blunt terms, you knew you didn't need, you're going to need mop-up crews, basically in a nutshell. Hold the line in mop-up crews. You already had crews, which is not on the public record here, you already had crews in the pipeline to fill basically another week to do those missions out in front of you. So it wasn't the case of calling up, we're in a disaster, the houses are burning down, we need you tomorrow. That wasn't the case, was it? Walk through the assets you already had on, it was pre-planned, and then from there move into the training pieces of, what's the requirement for ODF, which I've learned since our discussion? There's an ODF requirement for state fires pure, then there's a federal requirement, and then, of course, that then gets passed on to the military, who will go back to that. But we walk through things in my office that aren't on the record that need to be on the record.
Yeah. For the record, again, Doug Graff, Chief Fire Protection, Oregon Department of Forestry. The decision to deploy or to train and then deploy National Guard troops, again, we had opportunity to look forward and know when that time of need was coming. We had three fires on the landscape for consideration that we knew within a couple weeks we were going to have challenges with capacity of existing crews to hold the lines. One of the key drivers to note in this was the contract crews and that were on the scene on the fire now, after 30 days, they get 2 days of rest, and then they return to the highest priority fires. Mop-up is not the highest priority fires. When we were fighting initial attack fires, fires threatening communities, we knew that's where those crews were going when they timed out on their 30-day assignment on that fire. So we have time to know when, through attrition, we'll lose existing crews on a fire. That dictates when we need to pull the ask for the request for the National Guard training. There are 5 days specifically of training from a citizen to a entry-level firefighter that we require to be prepared to go onto the fire line, to understand the communications, understand the environment with which they're operating, understand the mission that they're being asked to do, the management organization, the incident command systems. With the military, we're fortunate for the command and control is already there. They understand those systems in place. So it's the specific duties of fire missions that we need to train on. So ODF has a requirement, and through the national firefighting system, there's a 5-day training for the entry-level firefighter, and that's what we train the National Guard crews on. I think I'll turn it over for, before in advance of that 5 days, I'll turn it for the military department for specific on how we transition them into that training.
Dave Stuckey, Deputy Director of Military Department, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. From the actual training construct itself, taking these citizen soldiers and airmen off the street and putting them in, we have 1 day of alert and mobilize at their home station. We didn't deploy, since this was a volunteer mobilization, if you will, we didn't say all of Charlie Company, Roseburg, report to drill, you're going to go fight fires. So we had 10, 20, 30, 15, 7 coming from all different armories throughout the state. And so once we got those guys mobilized and put into place, then we just sent them down to TPSST for 5 days, and then the seventh day was actually get them out to the fire. So we found it to be a fairly fluid process.
Senator Courtney,
you had a question? Yes, thank you, Chair. I don't expect the Oregon National Guard to answer this question, but I'm going to ask it. Was the Oregon Guard called out late this year in the fire season?
Chair Boquist, Senator President Courtney, we were called out when we were asked to go.
And that's so what I thought you'd say. So you're not answering the question. Were you called out late, our state forester, whatever, Deputy, were you called out late during this year's fire season? Given the role that you say you play, were you called out late?
Chair Boquist, Senator President Courtney, when we were called out, to do the mop-up duty, and we were called out at the right time for the mission that those soldiers and airmen were assigned to. I went out there, I saw what
they were doing.
There
were so many resources fighting Oregon fires, there wasn't enough in other states. They were short in other states. And all I'm saying is, I don't know, it's great if you're living in the state of Oregon, I suppose, but I am surprised that the Guard wasn't moved to the line much sooner, given the extent. Now, I've never understood your role versus hot shots. I'm starting to understand it's nowhere near what hot shots are. You're never on the fire line. So maybe it doesn't apply to you, but I am surprised this season that the number of resources in Oregon was so extraordinary at one time. At least three other states did not have resources to fight major fires, and that was noted. And I don't represent those states, I don't live in those states, but you know, in the end, you're all brothers and sisters in this mess when this whole thing was burning up this year. So I have long wondered why the Guard wasn't called out earlier to the extent that they had a role. Because I thought you'd go much sooner than you did, much, much sooner than you did would go.
Chair Boquist, Senate President Courtney, Doug Decker, State Forester for the record. I think Doug Graff spoke clearly about the kind of the mission. What is the mission parameters for the National Guard? And I appreciate your recognition of that. It's really to protect the investment that has been made in Fireline. I think the timing of mobilizing the Guard, knowing that, you know, we have a 5 to 7 day threshold, we have to kind of know where things are going to be or really make our best estimate at where fire conditions and resource levels are going to be 5 to 7 days ahead. To be able to feel confident that the workload, the specific mission, the type of work will be there for Guard mobilization. There have been times in the past, in fact, in 2008, we went together, we went through the process of training up 300 guardsmen, but they weren't deployed because the workload was not there. The mission critical nature of work wasn't really lending itself. So I feel like they were mobilized at the right time, given the amount of mop up and kind of line protection reinforcement work that needed to be done at that point.
Well, I guess, if I may, Chair, one of the fascinating things is once they're called, they don't go up. They train for days, which is very confusing to me. I'm going to be frank with you. I don't understand, given the citizen soldier role they have, whether it's floods, crowd controls during riots, whatever, that is who the Guard are. And I am surprised that it takes five or how many days to train them up to whatever they're doing versus your call, we're going. Mm-hmm. So that whole thing I struggle with, that even though you're running the show, you're making the calls, I'm not. Until the fire issues are brought under control, if they ever are in our civilization, if you're going to have the Guard be a serious firefighting force, the training, I don't get it. And I still am unclear on when you go and when you don't go. You have such massive types of equipment and resources to move. I don't get it. Because especially when the resources are being stretched so thin this year. I why are you never on a fire line? Why they don't literally convert you to the first wave as they we are in other types of battles. Why aren't you? I don't get it.
Let me just jump on the back of the president here so that you understand the ambush you're getting about ready to walk into here. In 1989, and I don't know if the two of you were here in 1989, but Dave, you were here.
Sure.
I mean, this is the only ironic portion. We have not changed the name of our plan, Smokey, since you and I started as privates, okay? So it's still the same plan. But in 1989, you got 1 day of training. And you didn't have to pay for it. The feds paid for it. It was part of the National Guard. We had to do one drill weekend and do the fire planning, and you went out. The basic fire course for the feds, federal government on the fire, according to their own stuff online, is 3 days. I get the 5 day thing if you're starting from scratch, and then there's the leadership training issue that's there. I know that maybe the two of you weren't around, but in 1989, which is my base parameter of this when I was in the Oregon Guard back then, is that of Senator Courtney. I'm struggling to figure out how we're going to use this in a catastrophic emergency in the future. We went from 1 day of training, it's now got to be 5 days of training, and even with 5 days of training, our sergeants and our lieutenants don't have, I get it, the incident management course, all this stuff. I saw the matrix. So over here, they don't have that training to go lead the 10-man crew that's on the deal. How did we get from 1989, which may predate you, where Senator Courtney and I think are both coming from, is, okay, we used to pick up the phone, and we're going to go back to that in a few minutes of, you know, federal homeland security mission. Just what in Christ is that, okay? I mean, if it's not fighting fires, then why aren't we able to pull federal money? But from the training aspect that Senator Courtney is talking about, how did we get from 1 day to 5 days that it takes to get them to go out? That's your requirement, it's not the military. You guys have the requirement. How do we get there that now put the constraint on the Guard that says, well, we can't go unless we have the certificate or whatever it is for 5 days?
Yeah.
I don't know what predates you, but you're the one who said 5 days.
Yeah.
And the federal line does say 3 days. And I have been told, and we discussed in my office, that as a private landowner, you invite me to send my employees to a one-day training course every year, and they're good to go and fight fire. So I'm slightly, and I do understand the complexities and the difference, as Senator Courtney is pointing out, but there's a long ways from 1 to 5.
Yeah. Senator Courtney, Chair Boquist, a couple thoughts for the deliberation here. One thing that's unique for the region that will help in this discussion for the region, it's Oregon, Washington. We have access to the contract crews, and that makes a distinction from other states in the West. This is unique to Oregon and Washington to have 190 contract crews. So I think we'll see other states relying more quickly on National Guard boots on the ground because they don't have 190 professional crews available within the states. So that's one factor that adds into play. So I think historically might not see the numbers of deployment within this region and others. So that's one thing to consider. The other thing to consider is the need for the crews, which was paramount for most of the season that you heard about, was at the Type 1 level. The hotshot crews are very limited nationally, and those are the first ones called out for the challenging fires, and we hear that and saw that throughout the season, that they were on the wanted list pretty much throughout the fire season, and we had fires that had Type 1 crew, hotshot crew, ground, steep, rugged terrain, that we wanted that expertise. Another point of clarity, I think, for the conversation is, Senator Courtney, the training of the boots on the ground National Guard troops, we do put them on the line. They're patrolling and mop up. They do walk the lines, and there's always that constant threat that the wind shifts, a tree falls, fire drop goes across the line, and they're immediately into initial attack. So I may have painted a softer picture that they come behind the fire front and they're not actively engaged. We have to train them to be ready, to be prepared if the worst happens. And it happens at times. We'll put a line in. We'll hold it for a week. A cold front will come in and blow that line up because there's still heat in the ground 100 feet in from those lines. And these guardsmen are chasing 1,000-acre fires just like anyone else is and fighting initial attack. So over time since 89, the landscape has changed in terms of the training, the complexity, and how we fight fire. And those training standards have changed. The guiding principle around how we engage in wildfire within the nation is through the National Wildfire Coordination Group, which states have a seat on that. And we voice our thoughts around, you know, what are the standards out there for training? What makes a firefighter one, an entry-level firefighter, and what are the standards for training? And for the National Guard, we've agreed that we want an entry-level firefighter to be prepared for that full range. I may have misspoken. I'll follow up on the details. There's a day of field training that occurs, and I thought that was after 4 days of training in the classroom. Yesterday, I referenced 3 days of training in the classroom and a field day. So I think that's the confusion around the 3 or 5 days.
Let me dispel the confusion. In my basement, I still have Hood River training plants. You went out in the fire line in your career too, right? I went out in the fire line in my career. And I get it. Back then, the Guard paid for this. The feds paid for the 1 or the 2 day drill weekend in the training zone and so forth. And it was 1 day. Once again, though, as a landowner, you guys publish, and we get this list that says, you know, come attend this course. And, you know, it's great for insurance, I guess, workers' comp. But, you know, we get this one-page list that says, you know, we got a certificate because we went to the 1 hour, which is sort of a refresher course. And then, you know, I did look, the 130-190 basic course, right, for federal fires, for going on a federal land, the typical person that gets out there is a 3-day course. I can register for one. There's courses in Oregon. I guess the biggest academy is down in New Mexico or Arizona or something, and I can go down there and enjoy the sun and in the spring and get that, and it's a 3-day course. And, you know, I'm slightly irritated because I'm not in the same boat in this because these guys went to hell and back, okay? They already know about leadership. And, oh, by the way, there isn't probably an active duty infantryman that hasn't fought fire in this country already. They already have some expertise here. So how we suddenly got from 1 day to 3 days is just an interesting intrigue. But at least how did we get from 3 days if you take a guy off the street and in 3 days he's suddenly trained, but we got to send the guard to 5 days. And we haven't even got to the point which, you know, I know, spare me in the military department, the dog paddle here. The problem with 375 is we all know how many of these actually are going to be available next year to do the one-day refresher to go on, and that number is debatable. But I'm trying to figure out why the standard is higher for 5 days of training with the National Guard now from 1980 to now. And it's my understanding from people who do this, and the only stuff on the line at the federal website is this is a three-day course. So I'm a little confused and back to here because these crews are going to be hard-pressed later on.
Or do you not know, and it's just, okay, that's the policy. And I don't want to beat it up and say, did the lawyers get involved and we have all these regulations now, but I just...
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I think what we'd be glad to do is to sit down and walk through the training syllabus with you so you can see day by day, hour by hour, what the expectation is.
I don't need to go through the training syllabus. What I'm telling you is the federal standard has a course that's 3 days, okay, and they get certified and go to the fire line. I mean, I get the course. Is it that the guard is not – it takes more time to train the guard because it's, you know, a different entity?
I think the guardsmen bring an aptitude, an organization, a discipline into the training, which is laudable and which we appreciate and which makes them successful. So it's that's not an issue. I think I also want to the 1 day that you'd mentioned the several hour recertification. I think that's apples and oranges from the training course, the kind of basic firefighter training course, the 130, 190 that you've described. That 1 hour or short day course that we do for single resource bosses, that's for folks who work in the woods every day, who can help essentially check a box, like you said, a kind of an insurance box. So kind of different animals. And I would also say that I believe that you would, and we certainly feel the incredible sense of responsibility for these people's safety. We recognize that we don't want to do anything that's going to put any firefighter, whether they're National Guard or a contract crew or a volunteer, in any type of compromised safety situation. And so right now at the national level, the certification for a basic firefighter basically says, as you've described, you've got a three-day course to go through. We put a one-day practical exercise on that where folks are out digging line and working with our resource, our experienced firefighters. And then we've got transportation and mobilization on either end. And if we had a way to shorten that time frame, we would absolutely do that. They're a precious resource.
I don't run the guard. Can I just ask a question? The guard trains, what, once a month?
Chair Boquist, Senator Courtney. Yes, sir.
Why don't you train before the fire season, just in general? So just in case. Why don't you take care of it all? Don't answer the question. I don't want to. This thing's got to end. I don't understand. Oregon's going to have a fire season. That's just the way it is. That's the way it's been recently. Why wouldn't you train prior to this? So you're just in case. I don't get that. Do not answer the question. I don't want the answer. I don't understand. I just thought this summer sometime, I must be wrong. Smokers everywhere, the whole state seemed to be burned up, and the guard is training. And I'm thinking, get them on the line. That's how much confidence and devotion I have to the guard. So that's all I want to say. I don't want to clear it up today. I'm sure the confusion is mine. But the training, I've heard training. The colonel knows all about training. I don't know what the guard's requirements are. But why wouldn't the training all be done prior to the season versus all of a sudden you need it, and then you bring them up, and we train them? I don't. That one I don't get. But it's all military. It's all federal. It's all guidelines. I don't want to hear anything more. I'm done. I'm through. You don't have to answer the question.
So actually, you do. Is there any effort on the military side, since, you know, our fine federal colleagues in Washington, D.C., and you know my thoughts on that, have said, you know, the Guard is the Homeland Security. They have the Homeland Security mission. Has there been any discussion, to your knowledge, at the general officer level in the Guard and in Northern Command in saying part of the Homeland Security mission is this sort of firefighting and going back and actually training on Homeland Security missions like this, like we used to. Now, I know there's a prohibition since the war, and now we're back. So has there been any discussion or any of the other adjutant generals pushing back and saying, hey, you know, we need to do some domestic civil assistance training other than riot control, which makes Jade Helm and the 6 o'clock news, and then our phones light up?
Chair Boquist, the answer is yes. Yes to at the NORTHCOM level, yes at the general officer level, yes at pushing back NGB. We are in discussions with California. We're in discussions with Washington to try and help push this rock up the hill with National Guard Bureau. We recognize that we would like to see certain rules and requirements and laws change that allowed for this to occur prior. In the old days, the state of Washington the legislature actually gave their military department $400,000-$600,000 in general fund to train them ahead of time. I don't think the state of Washington is in the capacity to do that today on the state active duty side. But I will tell you that from our standpoint, we want to see this. Our previous adjutant general, who is now the deputy commander of NORTHCOM, recognizes this as a weakness too. And I can tell you this is an issue. He came in yesterday, and we're having discussions about it yesterday and today before he flies out for his other positions, other jobs. And so yes, we would like to see those changes occur also. From the standpoint of why would we be able to put the federal government and the CST, and all of you know the 22-person CST element that we have out at the Salem Airport. Well, how can we do that federally, have them support the state? That paramedic that's in the back of the room, Oregon State Fire Marshal's office, whoever, those guys are going out there to help White Powder incidents. Those guys are out there doing state missions all the time. From our standpoint, we got 39 days of training. We'd like to see additional resources come. A guardsman has multiple actions and things that he needs to get done. So yes is the answer to your question.
It would seem logical to me that if other than BS from the federal government about Homeland Security, and that's the mission, is it would go even farther to answer the issue, and then we'll let the forestry people kind of close here, is to the issue of leadership training, which is crew boss training. I mean, it would make sense that there were, if Homeland Security was this, I mean, the types of crew boss training that they're talking about are the same things that are all hazard-wide, that incident management training programs, and I looked at the syllabuses that are out there, that they're saying are a shortfall for a 10-man guard unit. That's the same sort of training that you would use in incident management on all Homeland Security and all domestic operations. It would make sense that the federal government would say, hey, in the professional development of our non-commissioned officers and our officers, that we have these, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 block incident leadership crew boss trainings. Because it's not, I looked at the curriculum online, it's not, heck, it's not much different than BNOC or PNOC or officer entry course, really, is it? Yeah. To the department, is it probably a realistic statement to say that one of the reasons we've moved from a 12-hour block of training that we used to do in 1989 is that we have, for whatever reason, had a fairly significant number of fire injuries in fighting fires where crews have been burned up, where things like that have happened that are tragic, and that we have increased our training requirements to try and address those safety issues? I'm giving you a bone here.
Yeah, okay. Well, I would say in general, yes. I think the training standards have evolved as we've, as we've learned more about the complexity of the job, to keep those standards fresh, definitely.
Okay. Thank you.
And I would add to the earlier interchange about the role of the guard, we would welcome the opportunity to have the guard be a ready resource so that we didn't have a mobilization threshold like what we've been talking about here. I appreciate the fact that my colleague in Washington, I think last year they actually did train Washington guardsmen that were able to be mobilized on a shorter time frame. We would welcome that. We recognize the cost associated with that, and then the competition for mission time and that creates. But ODF would welcome that ready resource.
Director, when we're not in war, the Guard is a second-class citizen in the military, okay? That's just stated fact. The reservists are the same way. Traditionally, before 9/11, the federal government did, in fact, provide a block of instruction, and that instruction was done. And now the Washington, D.C. wants to say that, you know, they're the experts on homeland security and domestic support, but they ain't spending no money on it. And that's the issue at hand here, is you should train. Every infantry battalion, every field artillery battalion, help me here, every combat battalion used to get this block of instruction mandatory every year.
Senator Boquist, I don't recall that exact same instruction. I know that I had it in the tow battalion when you were in Hood River and I was in Silverton. I know I got it, to be frank with you. I don't recall of what status I was in. I did go on fires. I, quite frankly, there was better duty. It's a very, very tough, challenging duty, but it was also rewarding duty. So from the standpoint of how the requirements changed, if we could try and make the federal government do some things and in order to help offset that, we don't need to train 8,000 guardsmen.
Check.
So ultimately what we're trying to do is move a couple of rocks up this hill, I mean, in terms of the federal government. And so we're going to continue. We're not going to stop that. We recognize the value that the Guard plays to the ODF and the state.
Right. Just doesn't take 5 days to move the rocks up the hill.
Ready, set, go. Wildfire action planning program. Is that you guys do? Okay. Fire marshal.
Thank you.
I'm looking at that. Where's? All right, there we go. Here we go. We'll move on. Mr. Knorr, we promise to be friendly to you. You can bring whomever else you have with you.
Senator Boquist, members of the committee, my name is John Norm, the Emergency Operations Chief for Portland Fire and Rescue. I'm today representing the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association to talk about the Ready, Set, Go program. The Ready, Set, Go program is a program from sponsored by the International Association of Fire Chiefs that endeavors to help communities simplify their ability to educate their communities and establish a program for educating the communities on getting ready when a natural disaster is going to occur, most specifically wildfires, where it's being used most extensively here in Oregon. Once an event occurs, it says get set, things are happening and they're rapidly evolving, and the go part is it's time for you to get out the door. So what it really encourages is education on the part of folks. It ties in with the FireWise program, which is a program from the National Fire Protection Association, which tries to educate people on keeping a defensible space around their house, keeping their driveways wide enough and clear enough that emergency vehicles could access them to provide structural protection if necessary, putting in the kind of plants that aren't going to propagate a fire, changing your roof out from perhaps wood shake to shingle or cement tiles. And so working together, getting people ready once the event occurs, set and go. It's actually a very simple program. It's been it's being used extensively in Josephine and Jackson County right now with some successes.
Chair Boquist, committee members, for the record, Jim Walker, Office of State Fire Marshal. And just to kind of expand a little bit on it is that we've had three levels of evacuations that have been used across the state, level one, level two, and level three. And there's kind of been some confusion on what that means to the general public. So one of the things that was done working with Keep Oregon Green and the Oregon Department of Forestry and the Fire Chiefs Association and the Sheriff's Association was how do we better define what those levels mean? So if we say that we're in a level one evacuation, what does that mean to the community? And that's really that ready piece. That's the heads up. You've got a fire within your general area and there's some concern, so start thinking about it. And then a level two evacuation is really that set, meaning that it's getting really close and there's a lot of concerns that you may have to go, which is that level three evacuation. Because what we found over time is that people will typically wait till the last minute, and when they wait till the last minute and they actually try to get out, they'll get out with the darndest things that you could ever think of. People just want to save whatever they possibly can. So this Ready, Set, Go program really has some good tools for the communities to be able to use to say, hey, you know, what should I be really thinking about in that ready mode? And it's really those documentations, those photos, and those things that are critical for that person to be able to get out of there. So this is a program that was brought, the Fire Marshal's Office adopted it in about 2011. Again, has worked very closely with our partners. Based on the weather conditions that we were seeing this spring, we brought this training to the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, had well over 100 folks in attendance of that to kind of try to start talking about what this means and what this means to your communities. Mowing your lawns and cutting your brush when the fire's right next to you is a little bit too late to be making those changes. So this is really get out there ahead of it.
Constituents will be do the darndest things, let me tell you.
They will.
Could you give us an example on the ground? You had the Canyon Fire, which is heavy structural, right? And then I know the fire marshals, you deployed an incident response or a command group to the Grizzly Fire at Troy. Can you walk through on practical, real terms on the ground, what happens, how do you reach out to the public at level one, level two, level three, and what does that mean? I mean, the Grizzly was not bad. The Canyon, of course, is 50-plus structures, which unfortunately, the good news is that brings in FEMA money. But having said that.
Yeah, and the challenge was, as everybody knows, this was a very severe fire season, or what some would say is an epic fire season. We did mobilize six times during the Grizzly Fire, the Canyon Fire, and then the fire over in Warm Springs. We had three incident management teams out at that same time. The challenge with the Canyon Fire is I actually went over to the Canyon Fire, and the ready set part of that, or the ready part of that, occurred so quickly. You took a fire that went from about 300 acres to well over 30,000 acres in a matter of hours. It's a fire that came down through the canyon, which is an area that has absolutely no cell phone service. So the communications, trying to get a reverse 911 system in place or something like that, was extremely difficult to notify those folks, but that's what did happen. So it didn't really go from a ready, it went to a go immediately. The rest of the 15 days or so that incident was going on, though, we did have change direction numerous times. And what we did is work very, very closely with the local fire departments as well as the sheriff's office. And the sheriff's office has the primary responsibility of evacuations. And so we worked really well with our partners to make sure that we got that message out ahead of time. So even though the fire was running south from John Day after the initial fire spread, we talked to the folks in Prairie City and said, hey, by the way, you've got a fire right outside of your door. Here's what you need to really start thinking about. So we set up information booths. We sent public information officers within those communities to really talk about this program and some of the things that they needed to be thinking about, which was a good thing because about 6 or 7 days into that incident, it reversed direction and came into Prairie City, and they went to a level three evacuation. But there had already been discussions on what those levels were. Our hope is that this program is really used in April and May, and that conversation with those community folks in those fire-prone areas are educated before all of this does start. But there are some mechanisms that we do put in place with the local communities through our public information officers to really try to get that information out as quickly as we possibly can before it does impact their communities.
Appreciate the update in the brief. I don't care how you slice the weather, it ain't gonna get any better for a couple of years. So I mean, those issues that are out there, and as you point out, I mean, the number of structures that were burnt in the canyon versus the Grizzly, and of course, the Grizzly is just as a firefighting firefighting operation is just an intriguing study of how things have progressed since 1989.
Yes.
I mean, the wilderness area, which where they weren't fighting, fire blows in, you can't fight it, then it blows back out someplace else, it starts another place, and it's, and then, as you point, you send four or five incident, all these people back and forth, because you can't fight it, because of federal law, it just went everywhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, I am very familiar with that fire, because I have property on the edge of it. And at the same exact time, I had property on the edge of the Willamina fire. So I had firefighting equipment loaded up, ready to go either direction at the end of each workday to you know, fight fire, because sometimes they won't fight fire. And so you only have to protect your own land. So
yeah, but, Mr. Chair, that's a very good point, is that that is one of the things that we ran into, is that we train very closely with the Oregon Department of Forestry, and our incident management teams come together every other year for that training purpose. And normally what we see is our offices coming together on large-scale incidences, but this year was different in a sense that a lot of these were on federal ground, some of these in wilderness areas that have had absolutely no forest management. And so what we did find is that it threatens the community, goes on to federal lands, sit and wait for a day or two, then it comes back. And so that's what we really ran into on a number of these incidences, was that different landscape.
Right, and I think one of the things you heard, because I had, I mean, in the previous discussions, was that was one of the issues, too, is that we're probably going to run out of time because we can't fight the fire here, so it's going to come back in two or three or four or five days, and so therefore we do need to mobilize the Guard because we're not going to be able to leave this. To run what it is, but it's, you know, and that's why, you know, as you see, there appears to be a lot of work to be done on integration, but we appreciate your gentleman's work. Thank you. Last topic that we're going to talk is, because we are going into a short session, is if Mr. Stuckey and Mr. Smith would just come up very briefly. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And, you know, just outline to us what we can expect in the February session, because whatever we expect is going to happen the first week or not. No, they wouldn't. I was a crew boss. I was a battalion chief. So.
Good morning, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and hopefully not being mobilized for fire duty on the line anytime soon. But happy to be here to talk about some of our priorities. We sent out a letter to all legislators in advance of Veterans Day, highlighting a lot of the work and our thanks for everything that you guys did achieve in the long 2015 session to further identify more of our Oregon veterans, to reach out to them and to connect them to the benefits they have earned, both out of that federal VA, $2.5 billion of resources, but also our state and local and community resources as well. Our strategic pillars for our work for veterans across the state continue to be, how do we better target veteran services? How do we mobilize partnerships? How do we drive veteran engagement and awareness of what resources are available, and then continue to invigorate our own core programs? We are doing that out of this last session with the extra $1 million for county veteran service officers, the double training capacity at the state level, serving underserved populations of veterans, such as our aging veterans and our women veterans, the fastest rising demographic. Thursday, we'll be kicking off the Incarcerated Veterans Task Force with legislators and partners. We're in the works of extending the suicide crisis line for military and veteran families. And we were pleased to get a second award of the Highly Rural Transportation Grant to better serve rural veterans accessing largely health care benefits. Also beginning to turn on probably in the beginning of 2016, what we have had is a partnership with DMV to better capture data of veterans raising their hand to access benefits, doing the same with the Oregon Health Authority, similar to that DMV model. So we are proud of the outcomes that we're delivering and achieving, proud of the support that you have offered. Where we see still opportunity, whether February or going beyond into Gov's budget development for the next next biennial budget, continue to invest in and support county veteran service officers, continue to do creative outreach. Some of that takes staffing, but also better marketing and awareness and stronger partnerships. And also transitioning to 21st century database solutions. We are doing a better job getting these benefits and resources in front of veterans. We're doing a better job and a good job delivering on the direct services that we're responsible for. But our data systems and the platforms and a customer relationship management tool to better handle the referrals and to be able to actually track the outcomes would be key going forward on the data side. We have built a strong system to draw down those federal benefits. We believe we are still leaving significant federal resources on the table, both in disability compensation, further health care resources. But it is a strong benefit system. One area that we see a lot of opportunity is to build on the strengths of our veterans that they do have when they return, whether disabled or not, whether impacts from service or not. They have great leadership skills and core values to bring to bear. But as was discussed a little bit earlier before I came in, a wide variety of programs aimed at economic opportunity for veterans, whether it's on the jobs front, whether it's on the education front, whether it's on the small business support front. Not necessarily that we need to take control of those programs at ODVA, not that we need new programs and recreating the wheel, but to have an economic opportunity coordinator so that we could bring our leadership, our partnership, and our advocacy to bear for the economic opportunity of our veterans would be a huge step forward. One of the bills that did not pass last session, Senate Bill 87 on veterans' employment preference for public employment, it was sent from this committee over to the House side, a number of amendments working towards that passage. Rep Huffman and Rep Evans have been asked by Chair Lively to relook at that. If it's a small adaption off of what was a strong partnership effort, could see traction potentially in the February session. If it's a larger relook, potentially that kicks to 2017 longer session. Beyond those core budgets and a few targeted policy bills, we would also highlight the importance of honor and recognition. So next year in February, while you all will be in session, will be the 25th anniversary of the end of the Gulf War. So looking at how we can partner across the two committees to honor our Gulf War era veterans. And then also amazingly, next year in 2016 will be the 15th anniversary of 9/11. So also looking for some resolutions for our more recent veterans as well. But happy to take any questions.
No agency bill.
Correct.
I would ask you, in light to the last comment you made in terms of the chair tasking two House members to do something for the bill they didn't like from us. I don't believe you were in the room, but if you would, I mean, that issue dovetails with the issue Senator Canope brought forward earlier. I don't believe you were in the room, but if you'd review that, I would appreciate that. I mean, I don't know that a bill is necessary, but I mean, the whole issue, as you pointed out earlier, of employment bridge programs, reintegration, all that stuff that the federal government is going to cease to do very shortly, if they haven't ceased already, and we'll all be saddled with. So if you could look at that, I would appreciate that. And since you expanded beyond what we're doing in February, what is the status of two new positions?
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, so the two new positions, we continued the Aging Veteran Services Director position and then also had coming online a Women Veterans Coordinator and LGBT Veterans Coordinator. Right now, collecting applications, I believe it closes November 22nd for the Women Veterans. We'll go through that hiring process and then we'll quickly thereafter release on the LGBT position as well.
Thank you. Mr. Stuckey.
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I'm Dave Stuckey, Deputy Director of the Military Department, and happy to note that General Stencil is going to be promoted tomorrow to second star, and then he'll also have the investiture here Wednesday. And so one of our top agency priorities is just the Adjutant General getting his arms around, relooking at the strategic plan for the Oregon Military Department and the National Guard to ensure that direction is in solid footing. But there are a couple of things that we'd like to highlight here this morning. We got one slide, just one. And so the first off in the legislative session, at the top, we assuming that capital construction is opened up, we would certainly like to reseek possibilities for a $6.5 million general obligation bond. Between that and the $5 million from university systems, we'd like to transfer over that RTI building over to the Western Oregon Western Oregon University. The second item under the legislative session, we have a GIS budget note. And so that 911, Senator Olson's had a lot of experience in that in the past, and we want to make certain that we are able to shape forward and provide a good recommendation on how we're going to shape the GIS data collection and how that feeds into the 911 systems. And so we have a budget note. We'll be certainly briefing that to the Information Technology Ways and Means Subcommittee. This certainly is a collaborative process between us and Department of Administrative Services. Last item under the legislative session, wildland fire funds, we'll be looking at some seeking some limitation, just appropriation. I mean, we spent about $3.2 million in general fund for this past season. The next two major bullets, I'd like to continue the fire theme if I could. First off is the hazard mitigation grant program. So that middle bullet, so FEMA federal government did something right, and we're very, very proud of that. For many years, they've had this FMAG process where they've given money out for response. But when the response goes away and ODF walks out the door, what do you do with that land when you want to make certain that it handles the winter flood impacts? And so what they did is they created this new hazard mitigation grant program. In this case, it's tied to the 6 FMAG fires for 5 counties. And this program is going to be, it's very similar to how mitigation was working in a disaster when we had a flood disaster. All of you know that big major presidential declarations that we have. Well, now after a fire disaster, they'll be able to send us some money. And so some of that money will be able to go back into those areas that were hit hardest in fire. And it will be projects like managing erosion, just simple little things like erosion or seeding, aerial seeding, stream gauging, redos, or upsizing culverts. And so it's kind of exciting. It's new. It's mitigation. And in theory, what we do now, we can be able to ensure that we don't have that winter flooding impact in Grant County or wherever this coming season. So that's basically the middle bullet. And then the very last one, we're talking pre-disaster mitigation. That's a long-term program within FEMA, but in this case, on the fire theme, this is a fire management grant that helps mitigate and reduce some of the shrubbery. In this case, it's in Deschutes, Crook, and Klamath County. And so this project is worth several million dollars, and basically we're just trying to eliminate some of those fuels in order to make those counties a little bit more fireproof. And so that's basically it, top level for us, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
No direct, appropriation. So restate again the February topics.
The February topics. We'll respectfully request a capital construction, assuming it's open, a bond for $6.5 million, so between four, putting it into Umatilla. And then at the same time, the $5 million that the university systems will give us. And so those two will be combined together in order to recreate something out at Umatilla, and then that RTI building can be transferred to Western Oregon. We have a meeting coming up with the president of that university, and we want to be able to communicate to him what our plans are. That is our long-range picture. So that's one, assuming capital construction is opened up.
Is there federal matching funds of some sort?
There is a minor issue in terms of we have to repay the federal government, NGB.
Because the
25 year, and I don't know what the exact cost is today, Chair Boquist. The second point is just the GIS budget note. It came out of the 15 session. And then the third one is we just need some more limitation to cover our state active duty costs for this last fire season.
Right. I hate to go back to fire, but
I think I opened the door.
You should have shut it before you opened it.
Yes, Chair Boquist.
You made mention in the training program, because you see this, because this is a different entity. FEMA dollars generally are tied to fires in which you have structures that are lost. So it's really a
threat.
For us in the state, it's a bad deal, but a good deal. It's a case if you have to lose a building before FEMA starts kicking in and paying money towards the fire. But you did make mention that FEMA had put up funds for a portion of the training. Were those funds tied to a specific fire in which structure was lost, or is there a different FEMA program out there in which that, or do you not know, in which FEMA paid for a portion of the training costs, which is preparatory versus something already burnt down?
Chair Boquist, I may have misspoke. So that middle bullet here that's talking about hazard mitigation, mm-hmm. is tied to mitigating after the fire occurred. So there's no training.
I'm talking
issue.
About back in the training. I thought I heard during the previous discussion on train up that FEMA or some federal agency or BLM, somebody kicked in training money.
Okay, BLM. BLM. So this is between ODF and BLM and how they were covering the cost for us
right,
to get trained.
BLM
it's not something that it was within our purview.
Right.
Okay. Yes, sir.
I got that. Thanks. Other questions? Yes, ma'am.
I heard a report about homelessness and the money going into homelessness, and they have taken a number of veterans off of the streets. And I'm not sure who, which housing person told me that, but evidently some of the money that we appropriated is... they're directing it at housing homeless. veterans, and you know, because I think we designated some for mental health, and I forget how they're distributing that. But it sure would be nice to find out. And I'm sorry, I can't remember who told me that. You know, because that is good news, and the more we get the word out that there are now beds or housing for our homeless vets, and they're taking advantage of it. They don't want to. Some homeless want to stay on the streets, but many of these veterans didn't. And then I want to talk about another issue. I'm so nervous about what happened in France with ISIL. And I think you, is that how you say it? ISIL. Right. Yeah.
Or Daesh.
Well, I would think that that's happening in the United States too. And it can be happening in Seattle or Portland. And I am just wondering, well, 15 states closed their borders already to immigration of, I'm not sure who, is it Syrians, is it, I don't know. So is Oregon involved in that kind of thing, or is this just something that you don't talk about in public?
We have a state coordinator for refugees. Every state does. I have no idea what agency is housing. I'm maybe even in the governor's agency in terms of that. I believe the last number I saw nationwide in the last 4 or 5 years is only about 2,000 Syrian refugees have actually come to the U.S. A lot of news about what they're doing. In terms of it's the Department of Justice that runs the Fusion Center, which some of us, I sit on that oversight group for that as an appointment from the president. And the sorts of events that transpired, you know, in Paris and elsewhere are very, very hard to prevent in any particular scenario. I mean, the risk is there, and the risk has been higher. And so I don't know the details. I did see that one representative sent a question to the governor asking him who that coordinator is and what is that status in the state. I mean, I don't know the answer, and I haven't followed it, but I think committee staff would be happy to follow up on that. And I would be happy to provide you the background reports from what has just transpired that we get in the legislature.
Well, it's scary. And
it is.
You know, and it's probably happening in the United States, too, and we'll just sort of have to wait to see where it happens. And it's something that I don't like to talk about. I'd rather put my head in the sand and not think that it's going to happen because it scares me horrendously. But I just wanted to bring it out and would love to have information on what
the law enforcement ability to respond is embedded in the DPST training program, which they do a good job of that. And if you recall, they've been over here in regards to the active shooter training program and hostage negotiations and things like that. And that annual update is actually this evening from 6 to 8 p.m., which all legislators got invited to at DPST. And I'm going, and I'm sure there'll be handouts, and I'd be happy, if it's not on your calendar, to share that with you. And I'd be happy to come around and share the other reports with you, too.
Well, I know people don't like profiling. I mean, you know, I don't like profiling. But when it comes to national safety, I feel that we need to take a look at who's coming across our borders who may be a threat. This is out of my area of expertise, but.
Well, Madam Vice Chair, since this is fairly a new phenomenon, it's out of the expertise of a lot of people, which is the challenge. I mean, it's a big challenge. Other topics I do have on my list here, one thing in returns of that during the next session, and Director Smith brought this up, is recognition of veterans. And if you remember, we passed, and I guess some of us thought we passed something slightly different. And I'll take the lick on me and the buck stops here, is in order for a veteran to be recognized who is deceased on one of the memorial highways that Senator Courtney carried the bill for across the state, it still takes a concurrent resolution in order to get them a sign so that the family or supporters of the family can purchase the $800 sign and put it up on a highway. I've asked good committee counsel here to look and see if there is some other mechanism that we might do in the state other than every time, you know, that a family has to go through the entire legislative process still to get a sign put up. I mean, the volumes and the names aren't that long. I mean, I don't know what options are out there. Maybe it's like the military academies. Maybe we could look at something along the lines of, you know, your state senator and your representative, you know, have to sign off on a form. I think many of us thought that, you know, this was all going to be handled by the Department of Transportation now, and in fact, it's not. It still requires one of a bill. I call it a bill. I get it, Mr. President. It's a concurrent resolution, it's not a bill, but it still requires an individual member of the legislature to use, like in the next session, one of its two bills to help those families get that recognition, get that sign. And so we're trying to look at some other mechanism that might be more accessible than, you know, having to come back to the legislature every time for every one of these.
Along those lines, Mr. Chair, I have the concurrent resolution for two brothers that were killed in Vietnam, mm-hmm. 2 years apart, and they'd like to put a sign in Boring. Mm-hmm. And I have no bills available. I was wondering if we could make that a committee bill. If everyone would agree, we'd pass those down. Sir?
Have we used up our committee bills?
No, we haven't, and we can use a appropriate relating clause. I don't want to say more than that with the Senate President sitting next to me. We can use an appropriate relating clause to, I think, put some of these things through. But I'm wondering even in the short term if we should not look at, you know, reaching out to all legislators and say, oh, and I don't know if this is possible, and if we're looking at solutions, is to reach out and say, hey, you know, maybe the Senate Veterans Committee will do one bill and we'll be able to address all these so that individual 90 members aren't using up all of their stuff and people are not dropping underneath the carpet and not getting the recognition they do, because it does require, you know, a bill concurrent resolution. Right. So if any of you have exceptional experience in the legislative process and have ideas, I'm open to those ideas. So.
George Wright graduated with me from Gresham High School. So I know George. I knew George. I didn't know his brother.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And with that, colleagues, I think we are done for the day. I appreciate it. And again, if anybody has any ingenuity ideas of how to resolve the recognition problem issue in regards to road signs and that support, please let me know. And with that, colleagues, we are done until the month of January.